Hello, everyone. I want to welcome everyone to our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting live Discord interactive podcast. We really aim to kind of bring topics related to either threat hunting or security in general to the episode. And in this one, we're really focusing on the intersection of AI kind of in general, but we'll also be talking threat hunting as well. What problems really emerge and what problems get solved. Just a reminder, throughout the podcast, we'll be taking comments and questions from our Discord server. So if you join that and go to the Out of the Woods channel, feel free to ask questions, add comments, or whatever. We always try to even call out things if there's things that are interesting that are brought up. We love the engagement. And so before we kick off every episode, we always do some interesting artifacts. And this week we'll kind of relate those, or this episode will relate those to AI. But before I really jump in, let's do some introductions. I'm Scott Poley. I'm a senior threat hunter. I'm at Intel 471. And I'll pass it to you, Tom.
Hello, everybody. Tom Costura. I am a threat hunter here at Intel 471. Kind of a cyber junkie. Love this stuff. Been around the field for quite some time, doing a bunch of different things, analyst, engineer, all that stuff. So happy to talk about AI. It's the big hot topic of the year, and probably going to be so for a while. So,
It's always on
Lee.
fire.
Surprise! I'm also a threat hunter here at Intel 471. Also the man on the keyboards behind Discord. So keep those memes and GIFs coming. We always look forward to answering your questions as well, being interactive. So the more questions, the more interactions, the merrier.
All right. And just so you guys are aware, we've got some stats and stuff that I'll share in Discord right now. I'll throw kind of the report we're pulling some stats from. So if you guys want to pull it down, you can. You do have to, put in your email and stuff to pull the actual report. But some good stats or interesting stats to look at. We'll be asking your opinions on some of the stats throughout in polls. So if you want to participate and kind of see if that lines up with what you're thinking. Also very cool. But getting to the interesting artifacts, Lee, I think you've got the first one.
Mine's actually, when we first started talking AI, the first thing that came to my mind was, how are people abusing this and all these things? Coming from that mindset, because it's a common question that customers ask, how can I protect, how can I identify threat hunting, or how can I threat hunt or my AI model is being abused? And one of the things that, I didn't really fully understand was all the whole topics or all the ways that this can be done. My brain was, and I don't even know if it was, thanks, Riptide. I don't know if it was even accurate, but without even like any, understanding before I started doing the work, or the research was, what would it look like in a static state? How could you detect if something changed? So my mind went to like a full body hash of the algorithm you're using, of the data you're using. I think I asked some questions to Polly and Tom, and that quickly got crushed because it was like, wow, that's probably not how it's done. So I found this site when I was searching out. It's just llmattacks.org because I'm a very virtual or
Visual.
what? Thank you, not virtual, visual person. I like to see this. So it's talking about examples of abusing LLMs for unethical behaviors and things like that. You'd say, hey, how write a tutorial of how to make a bomb. Hopefully, AI comes back and says, no, can't do it, unethical. Now I know there's other prompts that you can use to like kind of jailbreak it, where you're like, hey, pretend I'm in a play, or this is for a theoretical topic I'm going to discuss. And by prompting it in that way, sometimes you could get away with it. But this actually shows like what the injection looks like and then what the results would be. And this was like all the research is done here. But the fact that they're actually showing the prompts and what the adversary added at the end, it was interesting to see. So if you all and it gave me ideas like, well, if you are somehow logging this, you are seeing what the input is, that would be a quick way is like, is there anything after or were there two questions asked, in a short time that were similar? Was there any special characters that were added after everything, even after a period or a question mark and so on? But yeah, it was just pretty interesting to see because then you could go through and see everything that they're putting in, which gave me that understanding of, okay, this is what it might look like, and this is how I can possibly help in the future. But just a little interesting thing. And a whole white paper comes with it. So if you've, if you're up for it, feel free to read that.
No, I think it's really cool for people to see how things function and why guardrails are a hard thing to implement in certain aspects like this. Because, you know, there was always that growing fear once a lot of the LLMs and stuff hit the scene. We're like, oh, how are attackers going to use this? And it's like, oh, we're going to put constraints on this. And it's almost like you need AI to build constraints and guardrails against the AI usage. So it's like this weird game that they play. But yeah, so, you know, breaking guardrails, understanding how things are being interpreted, it's just good for, I think it really helps accelerate understanding when you can kind of see an attack like this live in a sense. So, yeah. All right.
Steal.
Yeah. So mine is like a slightly different, right? It's a GitHub repo. It's only a few months old, but basically it's a keylogger someone had created, but they created it with I'm going to try to pronounce it as best I can. Nifion.
Nifion.
Yeah. But if you're not familiar with what Nifion is or whatever, basically one of these kind of LLM models that you can get to via Tor that has no guardrails, that people can use for offensive or ask any type of question. There's no really restraints on how you use it. And I haven't like tested the actual keylogger that was created there, but it's an example where someone is sharing something that potentially was created using these types of things. It's an offensive nature, and actually, you know, what potentially could happen if there are no guardrails for assisting, you know, actors. So it's interesting to, you know, maybe play around with this, see if it's actually built well enough to just run. I'm assuming it is, if it's still, you know, up and alive, or, you know, they felt compelled to actually share it. They've probably tested it. But it basically uses Telegram as the communication to share everything. So you have to set up Telegram as well as part of it. But yeah, you know, just an example I just wanted to share to kind of get people familiar that there are things out there that people use, and they are trying to use them to do whatever it is they do. And the guardrails, even if we put them on the most popular models, there's going to be things out there people can always leverage. So just always be aware.
The classic get out of jail free card statement at the bottom. Ensure you comply with local laws before using the software. This is for educational purposes only. So is Cobalt Strike. That's funny. I just feel like we should just dump the rest of the episode and just focus on getting this to run and
do
live.
Yeah, there's nothing that ever goes wrong with a live demo you're never prepared for.
Right. For educational purposes, remember?
Exactly. Yeah. We are the education. No, that's really neat. I'm always a fan of keyloggers because I love I just love seeing how they interact with the system, right? What new capabilities does it have? What are the traces? You know, threat hunter mindset, right? But this is like that bridge. Maybe that would be like the bridge for me to understand even more. Like, oh, well, here's what it's looking at and so on.
Yeah, if you could build it, you can test it. You can, you know, educate yourself on it. So technically educational purposes, but.
Love the warm and fuzzy feeling we get from a keylogger that's just sending the key structure up to a Telegram box.
Oh, I know. Like, I feel like if that works in a real environment, then you've got other things you should be worrying about. But, hey, Russia uses Telegram extensively, right, for a lot of their communication and XP stuff. So.
I feel like if somebody's compiling this live in your environment, you got way more problems, too.
All right, Tom, what do you got for us?
So just I have two links here. They're just a couple quick hitters, really kind of staying inside of the category or the topic of the day. The first one is a little shout to the taxonomy being built by MITRE called Atlas. Any that aren't familiar with it, basically it is a MITRE taxonomy similar to ATT&CK, but focused on the side of AI, machine learning, et cetera. Looks like it's definitely still being built and being updated and improved. There are constant updates to this. It does have the tactics, techniques, and sub techniques. What I also found interesting about this is there is a navigator inside of this page that will show you an overlay to the actual ATT&CK matrix, which the majority, most people should be familiar with, or it's at least common, relative common knowledge now. So I thought that was interesting. So you can kind of see some of the parallels or how some of the things that MITRE is mapping to these taxonomy areas overlay with known types of attacks and techniques. So that's the first one I had. I thought it was pretty interesting. I don't know. Have you guys seen this one yet?
I think what is interesting here is AI has only, I mean, it's been around for some time, but it's only really been in the spotlight like it is for what, year and a half, maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And MITRE's really good about when it builds its taxonomy, always referencing either real research where something's been proven or historical based attacks. And the taxonomy is this populated already, right? I think that's an interesting insight to me.
Yeah, I thought something very similar too. When you start kind of looking at some of the tactics and techniques, you see that these things were starting to be created in, you know, the early like 2020, 2021, 2022, which is great because it shows the forward thinking that, you know, people are already working on this, already thinking about this and providing resources for us defenders to leverage, which is absolutely always awesome.
Yeah.
The second one I had, I just thought was a good resource. So when we talk about AI and threat hunting, as we'll go through the rest of this episode, but when we think about AI and the cybersecurity side and kind of how it matters and where it matters, if you're not staying super close to the radar on this, which I think it's moving so fast, it's kind of hard for the general person to. Looking for resources that are out there that can help provide some of those things that could be help you get up to speed quicker. But I did find this GitHub repo. It's awesome machine learning for cybersecurity. I thought it was really interesting because it compiled a bunch of resources together. We've talked about different things like this, but it helps kind of center. But there were some really interesting things, a couple interesting papers that I started looking through. I like that there were some talks there, so you could actually, you can go the audio route. Some people operate better that way, but there's all kinds of stuff referencing AI and security, machine learning and leveraging and threat hunting, and many other things. So just a more of a resource that's out there and more of an echo of finding these kind of compiled resources to help us in this area. Because I think as a whole, as a community, we're going to need stuff like this to really keep us up to speed just because it's moving so fast and we're going to have to keep up just about the speed of light on this thing, right? I don't know. Did you guys check this out? What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, any dump of resources I think is awesome, especially if you're like new to an idea or a concept. It's like, okay, what can I get my hands on? And the thing that always gets me is the data sets. I love when there's like free data sets to like potentially play with. Like, you know, in the reality of it, I think I collect more data than I use because I have this like, I don't knee jerk, like I have to have it because there's going to be some nugget or value or jewel there I'll find if I ever look at it. But in reality, I don't find the time. I get sidetracked a lot of the times, but I always get excited when I see data. So there's that.
Yeah, looking through the data sets, I read that one, Unmanned Aircraft, and I automatically thought of Tom DeLonge and Blink-182 and Aliens and stuff. I was like, he would love that. But no, this is amazing. Like, I love this GitHub, love the resources. It gives you all the answers and all the tools that you need to figure things out. I mean, one of the biggest things that are normally missing are data sets, and the fact that they were able to provide a lot of stuff like that and you can just ingest it and make it happen is great. So thanks to all these contributors. How many? We got 18. I don't even know if it's going to work, but that's pretty sweet for all their hard work. Oh, it's going to spin live. Cool. Thanks for that resource, Tom.
I'm able to
look through this.
Yeah, I thought that overlay was really cool. I don't remember them doing that with the other taxonomies, like with the OT one over that. I think they were separate, if I remember, but I haven't looked at the OT tax in a little bit of time. But this was pretty neat. Because I think it helps with the reference points, right, to kind of how to think about it. Because sometimes the AI stuff will find its way just because of the way that it's explained. It might find its way over a cliff relative to like what we're trying to achieve from a cybersecurity standpoint. So the overlay I thought was really beneficial.
Yeah, it really is. Because, I mean, that's building in on something that already exists that you could expand your MITRE coverage with already now, you know, with that AI focus, which is huge. Is if that's what everyone's looking for, here it is. And surprise, MITRE did it. So, which, if you don't know, I'm a huge MITRE fanboy. They're great.
They get you a MITRE t-shirt.
Yeah, if anyone's from MITRE is listening, extra large, please.
All right, so let's segue into kind of some of the meat of what we want to talk about here. The first thing I want to touch on, really, it's really like how threat hunters could or are using AI potentially in different phases of the hunt. And when I talk about threat hunting, and I've probably mentioned it before, and I know you guys are familiar with it, but my favorite framework still is the Tahiti model. I know there's multiple models out there, and I feel like some of the other newer models kind of are more of a simplification. So maybe it's easier to adopt a process or a flow. But what I like about Tahiti is there's a little bit of complexity as far as like all the different things they include. And I don't necessarily think complexity is good, but I think it's good from a reference standpoint to make sure you're not missing something that could be a benefit, right? So I'll share real quick, assuming it'll pop up the image, but there's the process. I put it in the Discord, right, of the actual what the process looks like. And then the other piece of that is the actual trigger component. I like that just because it's really about how maybe you can start with when you build your hypothesis, you know, what's going to feed into your threat hunting in general. So that's there as well. And so what I want to kind of walk through is there's different phases within Tahiti. And I was going to talk about, you know, where, what you guys might think as far as what would be beneficial, and how you would see maybe future uses for, you know, helping out, possibly hurting, or maybe how you guys might use it today for some of the stuff. So the first real phase is that hypothesis development. So you guys have any takes as far as how you think the any kind of the AI intersection, right, benefits you in any way or benefits threat hunting?
Yeah, I'll throw the first start at this. I think the hypothesis development is one where I tend to get the most meat from. Really, it stems from a few variables, but a lot of it is being able to throw ideas at a board. So it's kind of like this instant whiteboarding, leveraging, you know, a chatbot or AI, whatever you want to designate it as, to help feed back information to keep my process going and spinning. It's never really that it'll develop an hypothesis by itself. It's more than right. I have this active feedback loop to help me design the thing I'm going for, right? To help me space out some of the flaws in my thinking. I can throw just the blanketed thought at like a ChatGPT and then help start spinning ideas back. So it really gives me that framework for the hypothesis. That's been hugely beneficial for quite some time, honestly, for a handful of years, like having that capability. So the first dart I throw at it, how that benefits, like especially towards a threat hunt, that's top of mind always.
Lee, have you poked the bear on using AI and hypothesis development at all?
So I really haven't, okay. Quite frankly. So I will tell you what I have done. I've tried in the past. I've taken different intel reports, dropped it in AI, asked for MITRE behaviors, stuff like that. Because really, a lot of the hypotheses that we create or that I've created, like that are intel based, come from these intel reports. So I've thrown stuff in there, and the biggest, I guess, and this was a while ago, I probably shelved it because of the results I was getting. But I feel like a lot of the TTPs were off, simply because they would identify a certain artifact and like cling on to that and look at the context. So don't get me wrong, they were still semi-accurate. I really still would encourage or would think that you need that human aspect of the expertise of understanding the context behind it, the process chain flow. It's a good start. It, like I said, it may have gotten better since I've done this. But if it could help you with that, I could, I feel like it would be beneficial. Now, also just real quick, the report that you mentioned or that you pulled a lot of these things from was talking about like insider threat, stuff like that. That's interesting. That would be an interesting aspect to think about, like if you can. And if you have an on-prem, if you could submit your documents of your policies and things like that into it and then throw something out like, how would I look for this? That might be something that is brand new where you are using your documents, your tools and policies to, you know, kind of decide of what would look wrong.
Right. Like what's out of scope or out of scope for how things should be done. Right. Right. Even if it's just like your standards and configuration stuff too, that'd be an interesting, it's almost like the, an AI auditor of your environment in a sense. And so you kind of gives you ideas of where to look. I mean, that's an interesting concept, I think. I do like the sounding board idea. I use that a lot. But the other thing I also use from my hypothesis generation is even if I come up with my own hypothesis, I kind of stress test it to try to figure out, are there other things maybe I might be missing to look for? Or for instance, if I see like a really interesting command line, I'm like, yeah, I would definitely be looking for these artifacts associated with this tool and these command line. But are there other characters I can use and replace like forward slashes versus dashes versus whatever to make sure that even if I'm going to build something that's, I guess, of significance, sometimes I can use AI to accelerate the research, right, of those aspects. They generalize my hunt more, maybe find ways to broaden it more or things that might be obvious gotchas right out of the gate. So it kind of gets my brain centered on, you know, what can be the most effective, even if I come up with my own hypothesis. So I'd use it that way as well.
I kind of use it as a confidence boost as well. Yeah. Kind of play like, hey, is this?
Yeah, but I feel like AI is always positive. I don't know. I haven't come across many responses where it's like, you suck, right? It's always exactly. Like, well, that is interesting, even though I disagree with you. You're like, thanks for that.
This is my hypothesis. Is it good? Yes, but.
Right. So yeah, I think there's a play there because I think that's like an open discussion aspect, right, of the process. So I think developing the hypothesis, that's very natural to use things like an LLM or ChatGPT or whatever you want to use. That makes sense to me. What about like data scoping and like query design? Have you guys ever tried to use it for things like that?
So I have for some query things. But I have to be honest, I haven't had a ton of luck with that. Like, it's definitely not a plug and play thing. I have personally run into issues in the past where I'm trying to maybe understand a query language in a little more depth or look at some of the advanced capabilities of a query language. And I'm trying to find a way to navigate my thought process into a structured query. And I might use the tool and try to get the reference points it's pulling from really to help me find the place where this is actually documented, because hand scraping tends to be a pain. But that is one thing, like side note, that's one thing that I think AI tools like ChatGPT can really help you. They can help you get to the resource on the internet pretty quickly. So you can say, hey, I need this resource, and they'll find it for you instead of you scrolling through Google. Most people may know that, but that's super beneficial. But for the query stuff, I do try to help. You leverage it to help me get there. As far as using something like that to develop a query, I have not had a high level of success with that. There tends to be some gaps or some, you know, I would stop short of calling it a hallucination, but it would be some gaps in understanding or using a resource that doesn't actually exist anymore. So something archaic that was in its training model, likely in its training model that just doesn't exist anymore or has been surpassed. So, It can help, but I have yet to find strong success to rely on it on a heavy rate.
So I still think that most of the content developers here, we've been working with the tools long enough that we can understand aggregation points and stuff like that. So like getting the base query is probably the most I've ever used it for, or get asked them like for a quick like you said, Charles, like, hey. What's that transform command for Splunk that does this? And it's like, oh, you can put, you know, like those features are really helpful. And like Tom said, yeah, using it as like a FAQ is great. Like, you know, hey, can I do this? Yes, you can. Now I have asked, I think, once again, going back to the early days, I've asked it like, hey, how can I detect or hunt for this type of behavior? Or what log sources would I need? Or what, you know, what event codes should I be looking for? I will say it does provide a, at least in the past, a full version, or not like a concrete list, and it definitely wasn't exhaustive, but it just wasn't like, hey, look at this log only. It's like, hey, you can look at Win Event logs if you have Sysmon, if you have PowerShell operational logs, if you are using the EDR, they're, yeah. You know. So it was actually pretty cool, especially I believe one time I asked it for a scheduled task. And it told me like, hey, look for this event code. Then look for command line arguments that include scheduled task. You know, like it gave me all these different options. I was like, well, that's actually pretty interesting, a pretty good result, especially if you don't know exactly what you're looking for or like a lot of work that you may need. So it was sweet.
Yeah, I definitely like the if can you produce a few different examples. And usually some of those examples, obviously, this is why I think emulation is important too. But if you get examples of what the data could look like, so you can help you think of those edge cases, but also make sure you're covering down really well and you're identifying the things that you're actually trying to identify. The other thing I think is interesting, and this is more kind of a newer thing, right? But a lot of the models now that you could use have a what's called RAG, retrieval augmented generation, right? A capability. And what that means is basically you can almost create your own reference documents as part of what its base is. So it kind of goes to those as like more the foundational truth. And then when you ask questions, it uses what it already has figured out from the model, but then it references basically any kind of materials you provide as the main source of truth and compares against that to give you potentially more accurate answers. And I only bring that up because I do think, like what we talked about with query generation and stuff, if you're able to get your hands on documentation for instance, all the weird functions and things you can use in tools or certain like structures or advanced queries and stuff like that as examples to be able to provide, I believe it becomes easier to say, hey, this is what I'm trying to do. Like I want to aggregate the data based off this specific piece of telemetry. And then after that, I want to do a comparison on this, you know, whatever. I feel like you get a lot more success that way. The hardest thing is getting a good form of all that documentation because sometimes it's broken up across multiple pages, right? As far as website content and stuff, you have to figure out how to dump. But I do feel like then it will actually say, hey, if you're trying to do this, use this function. So it kind of, I think, can drive you in the right direction. It might not get you the query, but it helps you come up with new ideas and how to leverage the tool, potentially optimizing things as well. So I've seen that, and I think that's kind of cool. And that's something that a lot of times I feel like people are always, you know, when they go to these tools, they set up the quick wins. Let's ask the question. Let's get the response. Versus trying to feed it information first to work with and then say, all right, but now this is what I really want to do. So that's something that I think can be beneficial. But yeah,
I wish list item. Wouldn't it be really cool if the developers of these tool sets considered putting in a functionality, like a trained data set that and put in all their like their documentation. So within the given query, within a given tool, you can say, okay, I want to do this complex query capability. I want to do X, and it already has that functionality within it.
It sounds so like there's in ChatGPT, if you have the pay for version, I don't know if it's like creating an agent, but there is something where you can create your spinoff and you can drop all your reference materials in there. And it's almost like a mini version of whatever you're trying to do a purpose built for.
Individualized. But what if like you had something like, let's say like a Splunk, right? And they just dump all their documentation into this model. And then you as, let's say an analyst or the person trying to go at the data, you understand your hypothesis, you've gotten through this point. Now you're kind of, you're a little bit stuck in between a rock and a hard place, potentially, because you're trying to understand how to find the data in the tool set, leveraging its capabilities, right? Whether it's the query language itself or the aggregation methodologies or anything like that. It would be pretty neat to see that. I guess I'm hopeful that technology makes it cost effective for, you know, these companies to do that.
Now,
the one thing
that I do think helps me a lot in general in the process, either with the query stuff or something else, if I run into an error, it's so much better when I'm like, this is the error I'm getting and it's flagging on this part. Can you quickly identify what I'm missing? And it could be like a simple syntax thing or something. And that saves me a lot of time. And it's really just a small win. But man, I don't know how many times I've been stuck on something that small for, you know, up to an hour of time. And I'm like, oh, I didn't have a comma there. And this really complex query. And this is what's been, you know, stumping me, whatever it is.
So
you do the horrible thing of taking that error, copy and pasting it into Google, and finding your way down 17
from. Oh my God, Google's the worst. Is that? Yeah. So yeah, that's, I think, is a huge win when it talks about query development. It's more like query troubleshooting in some aspects, right?
And emulation troubleshooting.
Oh yeah. All right. So looking at like more of the refining stages, right? But you know, if you're looking at how do you do like dealing with the output, right? It kind of references like resulting like clustering or behavioral pivoting. But do you really think, as far as getting the output, you guys have really leveraged, I guess, any of the AI type models for anything? I can see why you plug in, but I'll be honest, like I don't think I've ever really gone down that path.
So what do you give me a little more depth on what you mean by output?
Well, I mean, so I feel like the purpose of like looking at the output from an AI perspective is almost like when you it was purpose built tools, like, hey, if you run our tool and then you're gonna have, we can do some analysis in front of your results to help you make decisions on your results. That's how I look at it. But obviously there's no tool I've used that does that. I've heard of homegrown tools that do that, where people just have kind of like the data lake approach, and they do their own thing there. But I've never once tried to take all my results and push them into like, hey, help me either what's a logical way to group things, or anything stand out from this set that I should be paying attention to. So I'm wondering if you guys have ever tried that.
No, I think the reason was I'm very hesitant for results.
Well, so yeah, I mean, that whole like data leakage potential, like what sensitive stuff you might just accidentally dump. I mean, that's a great concern to have for sure.
And I mean, I might ask the generic questions, like I have a set of data, explain it to them and then go for it, then try it out. But I don't think I've ever trusted it as much. I do want to call out, I'm going to butcher this, Anirudh. There was a time when I was testing LLMs like ChatGPT or Perplexity with simple technical prompts, even something basically like a hex calculation, and the results were just flat out wrong. It was frustrating, especially when I couldn't tell whether the mistakes were in the logic, the model, or the way it was referenced in the source. So while AI native tools definitely have exciting use cases like summarizing CVEs or generating quick scripts, there's also this dangerous possibility. They can give you a very confident answer, sometimes even with a legitimate looking link, but it's just wrong. Or worse, outdated or misleading, and security has a serious risk.
Yeah, overconfidence piece, right? That's always a huge concern in AI, right? Because you don't know how they're formulating, you don't have insight into some of that.
Yep.
But you gotta check the work. Oh yeah. But from the output perspective, I would say I've always talked about trying to automate threat hunting to a certain degree, and that was once you've kind of created your threat hunt, you know what you expect in the results. You know there's going to be some noise in there, but if you were to compare your current results to previous results on the same hunt, there should be some trending, right? And maybe there is a value there, right? If you were able to incorporate AI to say, hey, I ran these hunts, here's the previous three runs, here's the current run, anything that's consistent, so it's like more noise, you know, or anything that's net new, might refine things, especially if you have a large enough environment and enough noise, maybe a volume that you can't really filter out or don't want to, that might be a great use case for that. But yeah, I don't personally use it, at least at the scale that we like typically threat hunt in, but I thought it was worth talking about there. What about, like noise filtering? You guys do anything, especially when you're looking at building queries and stuff like that, to help validate or, you know, determine what may potentially be noise? I know I have a few things I play with there, but I was curious what you guys do.
I've asked, like, what's a common parent process? Things like that. Like, what protocols would not be fitting in this use case, or which one should I expect? The normal, like, common things that if I don't want to sit there and spend a bunch of time trying to figure it out by emulating opening up a Word document, opening up a Word document over and over just to see what the normal process chain is. I'll go that route. I can't remember. There was a wonderful GitHub that I lost in that time, but it showed, and I could probably find it, but it showed the common startup process chains. And it was like, when you boot up your Windows computer, boots up, what does that look like? And I would ask it like things like that, like which, you know, what relationships will exist naturally that I could probably remove. Never specifics, like never, once again, never like trying to tie data to it, but just asking questions like that.
No, I think like how I try to validate things, like for instance, like think about like everyone's usually familiar with Windows, but we still come across weird executables in Windows and instances. You're like, well, I don't even know what that is or what it does or what's the purpose of it. So there's a little bit like that educational piece that helps you make decisions. But I like to think of it too, like what if you, your whole experience is all Windows and now you're trying to threat hunt Linux?
Mm-hmm.
Like that whole, like you know, you're changing your mindset. You have to understand something completely new, but you have a good understanding of security. You have a good understanding of how operating systems are, like what the function of them are and the things to consider. But you're then faced with, okay, I'm hunting for this thing that I know is bad and I see these other things in there, but I have no idea, right? You're almost starting from a clean slate. I think stuff like that is great because you can say, does it make sense that this runs this? Or why would this be doing this? And then, you know, those like normal behaviors, it's usually pretty good at saying this is normal because of X. And then it gives you something to either help validate something or at least understand it. And so for instances like that, I think are really, really like helpful.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it's really just echoing what you guys said. Honestly, I think the biggest thing I've used in this area was to help kind of define those kind of default whitelists, like things to query out just to reduce false positive, reduce noise. And that's a pretty quick win as far as I'm concerned. I've been pretty successful leveraging AI tool sets to do that.
And sometimes it's a good soundboard too. If there's something you want to exclude, you can almost do the inverse. Like, hey, I'm looking at this. Can this be used in a malicious way that you know about or that is known about? And you might get some feedback so you know whether or not you want to include or exclude something, right? It's just like a sounding board. It doesn't have to be 100% accurate, but prevents you from potentially jumping the gun too soon, right? Now the other phase, which I think is great, that I think I probably used the most, and we kind of already touched on it, but just that contextual enrichment piece, right? You know, after you kind of run your hunt, you're trying to understand your results a little bit better. It's kind of before you're really, it's like when you're making that determination, like you think you have something or, and what do you do next? Have you guys, you know, I know we don't do operational based things all the time necessarily. Lee, you might just because you interact with people in their hunt teams, with help them troubleshoot and do other things. From a contextual enrichment perspective, you guys touch on that much?
Once again, not so much. Well, gaining resources to support the hypothesis after the hunt was done. Going back to the reducing the noise, building that into the query as we go through the results.
I think that falls in line, even though it's like during the process versus the result process. But that's why I said we kind of touched on it a little bit. But I mean,
yeah, I definitely go ahead, Scott. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say, from operationally, I feel like this is like where I feel in any security orchestration or environment or program where AI can assist the most is just how to streamline enrichment to make the human the decision maker, not the worker, you know, so to speak.
Yep. Yeah, definitely leverage things for enrichment, especially around the idea of adding in resources or tagging or anything like that. I can tell you there's been many times where I go in with a hypothesis and I'm in, you know, mid form of building out the full hunt for it, and I start looking at the enrichment piece, and I'll leverage ChatGPT for helping me find additional pieces for that, whether it be
actor groups using this kind of technique, or, maybe including or giving me MITRE tactics or techniques that I might not have necessarily seen, right? Because as you're going through your building of a haunt, you can find your way into a very tunnel vision process, right? So you get to that hypothesis and then you narrow in. Having that enrichment piece has many, many times helped me broaden that, and sometimes leads into additional haunts that are like inside of an entire scope of package, right? So definitely this one's, I think, is one of the more heavily successfully leveraged AI uses for threat hunting.
Yeah. And then I think it plays into the last, piece, right? With that reporting or doing documentation. Like, man, no one likes to write documentation. And the better the documentation, the more valuable the work you do becomes. So I think this is, hands down, if no one's using AI for anything, if you can at least summarize your work and explain the importance and be able to communicate it to potentially different audiences, right? Like, because you don't know who needs to hear what and at what technical level, this, I think, is a huge help. Now, granted, you still got to be cognizant, right, of what information you're putting where and why and what controls or thoughts you've got going into it. But I still think this is a huge advantage.
If you can standardize the way something is written, I mean, like you said, that's a huge, huge advantage. Because now, if you produce a report the same way every single time, you, like, first of all, what you're doing is, things like having the executive summary on top. Leadership is now going to expect that. They're going to see that every time, and it's going to be there every time because it's AI. Then, overview, technical people can go to it and look at it and scrape everything they're doing. And I feel like not only is saving time with writing that report, but it's also saving people time when they're reporting or reading it. For the reason I just stated, like a C-suite may read the entire report, but the first thing they're going to look at is the executive summary. What happened? How do we do this? Yeah. And they know where to look. Yeah, right? Like, that would be the biggest quick win for using AI whenever.
And that's where I think, if you have reports that you've written that you like or the style, using those as almost prompts before trying to, it helps maintain that consistent structure too. Because I do think that consistency is big, because someone has to figure out how to get to the meat of the message every single time, because someone kind of presents it differently. People just don't want to take the time or energy after a while, right? Yeah. So.
Yeah, those, especially write-ups that are in that area, like when you're trying to give to leadership or C-suite folks, it needs to be distinct, direct, and a constant same formula, so it's easily digestible and you can get the decision making a lot faster. I used to think otherwise, honestly. Personally, I had a fault in my logic there, and I used to think that telling the story was more important than delivering the information. And I found out personally the hard way that that wasn't necessarily true. You need to deliver the information, and then the story needs to be probed for the rest, right? So there's kind of like this handoff, and AI can definitely help with that constant structure, that constant, constant kind of format. Like you said, you can kind of train how you're using it to build these summaries, so it has that same flavor, same direct flair.
I think AI would have agreed with you, Tom, though. I think you're okay. They say that was
which,
a good
idea. Which part? Which
the
part?
Story needs to be told, then the delivery.
Oh yeah. I always thought I'm like, yeah, I want to tell the full story, but you realize pretty quickly when you're trying to do that with people that need to make decisions fast, that leads you into some.
Yeah, it depends on the narrative, right? If like there's if it's a short story, I feel like you can get away with it, but if there's more to it, then you almost gotta get the actionables out. So I think it's dependent. But I
mean, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was gonna hit the next kind of like button there on where AI might fit in. But yeah, if you get something else to.
No, I was just going to keep rambling on about that whole thing. Like it's funny because it's called executive summary for a reason, and you sometimes get gung ho when you're coming in. You're like, hey, I know all this stuff. I'm excited about telling a story about this crazy compromise situation and defense and all these different angles and variables. And it's like, no, I just needed an executive summary so I know what to say. And like, oh yeah, I get a little, you're a little cowboy. And it's like, yeah, don't do that. It's an executive summary for a reason.
Well, I feel like there's times where I get excited about what I do and I want other people to be excited about what I do. And they're they hired me to do what I do so they don't have to, right? So it's like, just tell me what I need to know. Okay, I got it.
especially when you're passionate or like you want your team's work to be well represented so everybody knows, you know, the effort they went into it. But it's like they don't care about that. Just
yeah, because
they give the information.
They don't understand that, and you definitely want to communicate like this wasn't easy, right?
Yeah.
But,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the last piece I was going to touch on was when we mentioned it before, or I did when it talked about like some of the automation aspects. I really think that that retrospective, being able to say, okay, this hunt worked. If I run this hunt for a day, and then I run it for a week, or then I run it for 30 days, to be able to do it in time slices like that, and maybe have some analysis that can like lay over the top to say, hey, based on the results you produced in these time frames, these things stood out, and then doing that over a period of time, I think that's just kind of a cool approach. My initial approach when I was thinking about automation before even including AI back whenever was just doing like the diff, right, of reports and uniqueness and like trying to sort and stack that way to say, if we've already validated something in the past, let's like cut that out from the results and look at new things. So this is kind of another approach that takes any of the lift out. So
real quick, I realized we were leaving a voice out of this. So I asked ChatGPT, hey, where do you think you would shine and how would you add value focused on the Tahiti model? And I took screenshots of the answer. So they can help us generate strong structured and testable hypotheses. Technical path enrichment, reporting, automation, workflow.
And then it's generic enough to sound exciting, but not be useful. Yeah.
It can help frame some thoughts. You know, sometimes it does help frame some thoughts that you might not have put together in your head.
No, I agree. But like, that's always my challenge. And I'm like, just give me the answer. Kind of the same that we're talking about executives, right? It just give me, I don't care about the story. Give me the answer. It gets so wordy.
Or machine, just tell me.
Right. But you know, we kind of walk through the Tahiti perspective, but I think this understanding AI and how it's kind of being plugged in other areas, I think is also useful because, you know, one of the things as threat hunters that we rely on is telemetry and data. And if AI is going to be leveraged in many different places, it's going to be producing telemetry itself. And what that telemetry looks like or whatever might be other things we may need to either consider and what we do from a threat hunting process. Or how we interface with that data in general. So some generic areas, and I'll kind of call them out and see what your thoughts are. Like, does it make sense? You know, are you excited about it? Not excited about it? And, you know, I'll just kind of run through them. So threat detection is a big place, right? AI comes up. What are your guys' knee-jerk reaction with some of the stuff they're doing with AI and threat detection? Or you're just gut thoughts about it in general?
My first thought when I see this is if somebody else is doing it, all I hear is out of a box content and I get hives.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna lie. The variances in any given environment are there, whether we want to agree with them or not. Some people think the kind of stuff that's standard is standard, but it doesn't, my experience, it doesn't always work that way. So when I see the threat detection, I'm like, I'm excited because we can enhance that and we can help build and produce more of those things faster. But I've also seen where some of the, like, you know, things that are doing that, like the EDR detection tools, which, you know, and it's not necessarily AI, but it's more and more, there's certain tools that are being driven by AI. You're still producing out of the box results. You know, you're still getting many false positives, stuff that just doesn't make sense or is inaccurate. And so I tend to stall here when I see that one. Not that I don't think it could be possible. It absolutely could. I just think there's so many variances when you talk about threat detection. It'd be nice to see a general standard, but environments are too different. So even when you come with this like general layout of a given detection for a common technique that's in MITRE that's coming from a tool and they're building you this detection, I've seen stuff like that that's still, because of the way your environment works, generates those kinds of things. So I just see out of the box content and I get hives. Yeah.
So my biggest question is data retention. I know some EDRs don't go past like 30, 60, 90 days. Right. And I feel like if you're trying to train on data and you only have a 30-day trend, that may not be enough to say yeah, this is an anomaly. So you might start getting all these false positives and stuff like that. Like, for example, if I only open up Word once a month, wouldn't that be like considered an anomaly? But really, it's not, just because it's, you know, I agree with you, Tom, that this is kind of just like a wrapping in to save, you know, out of the box content. But I would say for EDRs, you know, there's a lot that needs to be adjusted. Now, if you're talking Sims, and I think I plugged it already in the Discord, but one of my favorite tools is the Splunk Machine Learning Toolkit. Now, yeah. when you talk about Splunk, we're talking about whatever your license allows, however months you want for data retention. Now you can start looking at larger sets of data and actually use AI for like what it, you know, and really it's machine learning. So it's, you know, the whole algorithm. I mean, I think that's what AI, that's what I equate AI to, a tool like a sim too. And it was just scraping through data, understanding it faster than possibly I could. But once again, the machine learning toolkit, it provides results based on data that they'll flag as anomalous, but they'll also show you everything that's not anomalous. So they will show you those results that are still in the data set that you're looking at. So, you know, it's not that kind of idea where it's like, only look at this, but don't ask what the other results were. Like, you know, what are we not doing? So threat detection, like you said, Tom, still needs tuning. Every unique environment needs to be accounted for, and that's where the human part comes into, and that's when data retention comes into, and, you know, what you're actually doing, I guess.
Yeah, so according to the Mixed Mode report, 63% of organizations claim they're using AI to detect attacks across cloud, on-prem, and hybrid environments. So it's there. If it's not already there, it's coming, right? So it's definitely something we have to figure out how to manage. And, you know, the benefits that are being claimed, like faster detection of novel threats, like 0 days or fileless malware. One, I think some of those things are interesting because they're very telemetry dependent. So if you're gonna say you can detect that stuff with AI, what telemetry is, I think it's better to use AI to figure out what telemetry it's using to detect that, so you can build detections and have a better understanding and more control over that, right? That's kind of where my head always goes, is like AI is really good to say these pieces of data are really important for this scenario. That's more informative to me than saying you should do something about this scenario, right? So that's, I know it's still black box, but I really want it to be the other way, right? Like I mentioned, I'm sure it can reduce false positives. There are, you know, if you're able, and you're talking about like just managing alerts, there might be alerts that are noisy that, you know, maybe that's a huge benefit there. But one of the things that was responded in that report too is 70%. So that's a, you know, it's interesting that 63% of organizations are trying to use it somewhere, but 70% of respondents say it's hard to integrate AI tools with legacy systems. So, you know, when you think about, all right, this is what I hate about security in general, is we have a really good formula for how to do things right. People start doing things wrong, or they weren't part of the solution at the beginning, so they kind of adopt whatever things are at their current place. And instead of fixing it, new technologies come out. They're like, well, we can just use this new technology and it'll band-aid this old technology. AI doesn't work if something isn't monitored or configured correctly, right? Because you need things kind of centralized. And then if things are fragmented or legacy, like that's a bigger problem. That maybe you need to figure out how to prioritize what you're actually upgrading to. So I think that's worth thinking about as well from the threat detection perspective. One of the other kind of use cases that people are using AI for, instant response. What are you guys' takes on instant response?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some meat to be gained here. Having this kind of comes down to that whole, can you put the data, all of the data reference points relative to a given thing in front of the person making the decision as quickly and as you know, as complete as possible, right? So a soft example, if I'm an analyst and I get an alert of a thing,
if AI can help drive that context around the alert to help me understand the different pieces, so whether it's the contextual gathering or whether it's the summarization of the given thing that I'm seeing or anything in between, I can completely see how this can help expedite incident response, because it's time to resolve is always the thing. If you get hit with something, there's a compromise, you want to resolve it as fast as possible. You know, that this is where I think there's a lot of meat to be gained. I do stop just short of it being like just a general offering, because I think this one also kind of follows a bit of the suit of it. It's relative to your environment, right? So something that's, let's say there's something you find, it's a really bad example, but I'm trying to think off the top of my head here. But let's say you're in finance and you find something and it's directly targeted at your sector, but then you find something similar in a different sector that doesn't have the same relevance, the contextual stuff, like from a given AI offering versus something that you've molded for your environment, are going to give you very distinct pathways to resolving that fast. You get what I'm saying? So there's still some complexities there, kind of like threat detection, where knowing your environment and the variables inside of your environment or your sector, they do matter. So I guess I stop short of saying that there's a, like, I would be skeptical if somebody came out and offered me something that said, yeah, it's just going to be incident response for you because it's an AI tool. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I should say, first of all, anything powered by AI, if it's AI just driving the machine, I'll probably already like, if you say it's like it has AI capabilities and like it's still driven by a main engine and then it's kind of like a feature, that's great. I think this is the point, and Tom, I think I agree with you. This is where adding to the SOC really starts empowering the users. And here's my mindset is automation was a great step forward. How do we get all those easy steps done for the analysts to make decisions quicker that are normally time consuming? Now AI can add that. You can use AI to add that context of, oh, by the way, like, you know, we looked at the data, looked at the report. This has only happened once in 90 days, you know. So now you have all the information. Now you have this little tidbit of like, hey, nudge, nudge. This is what was seen in your data. That can make you make those decisions. Now, I think we're maybe the enrichment phase, taking that and looking at and say, okay, if this has happened more often, how did we handle it last time? So almost feeding in your playbook, feeding in the other incident responses that have been done before, so that you train it to say, okay, these are the next steps you need to take, could be beneficial as well. Because if it's not, once again, you don't want to automate incident response to a point where it's like, we detected this, lockdown, right? Now, there are probably use cases for that. But if you can train it to understand what human decisions were made, what human actions were taken later on, and it spits out something like that, I think that might be really beneficial as well. Granted, you shouldn't always have a human making the decision of what to do after you have given all that information or not.
Now, I like what Anirudh was talking about earlier, about basically trying to enrich things with user roles, business workflows, assets, all that kind of stuff. I think that is important because when I think of actually going after an adversary or something, I always think of the human on the other end. And so if I understand the context of the human or asset or thing I'm looking at internally, there's like a core behavior or responsibility, or, and if I can create that perspective or context as I'm looking at something, I think that speeds up decision-making and accuracy as well. I think that's a huge thing. And K4Audix made a good point when we talked about like percentage of who's using stuff, because buzzwords are such a big thing in this space. Everything picks the most popular buzzword, even though they kind of bundle in deep learning, AI, ML, and all that kind of stuff together. So I do think those percentages can be inflated because of that. But I do think either way, these types of technologies are displacing other things or other security tools that, or investments in environments. So it could be a good or bad thing. But as far as instant response, they did report that SOCs are reporting that they get 51%, you know, efficiency, or the alert analysis increased by 43% of them say it's increasing their alert analysis. I think that all makes sense, right? If, especially If you can say, I have to handle less stuff as an analyst and I know something else is handling it, it's more that validation that's going to be the tough part. And like we were talking about with understanding the assets within your environment, having good incident response, especially if you want to automate or use AI, I do think it needs to have some sort of good training to understand the contextual knowledge of the environment versus some solutions that you buy that have AI in them. They can train them, you know, in their labs and do their stuff and then bring them in. But when it comes to incident response, there's a whole nother layer there that is dependent on the environment itself. So that's something that people, I think, should need to pay attention to. And then obviously, if you have over-reliance, you might run into some over-automation on responses that could also be impactful, whether it's high impact or not. You know, obviously, if it's high impact, you'll know immediately. But there's things that, you know, you could run into there. So it's kind of my take on that. Vulnerability management. Go ahead.
Real quick, before you get to vulnerability management, I just thought of something. I guarantee this is not brand new. But what it, like... And I think, Tom, you were talking about features earlier, and this might be stepping on it. I don't know. I think I was searching for the Windows boot up process graph that I found or that I saw. But what if, like, you, and I know you talk about features, and what if you could say, all right, AI, give us the alerts that are 100%, right? Meets all this criteria, so and so. And then you can ask it, all right, well, what about the alerts that you were like 75% on, but then some condition wasn't met so that it wasn't considered an incident or an anomaly. Can I see those? And then you could go through and retrain it on those to say, okay, well, you missed one. This was actually an incident. Or like look at the ones that are 50%.
I feel like most of the alerts give you their confidence level, and then you can build like your dashboarding or what gets sent to an analyst versus what gets responded to and things like that, from what I've seen from like preliminary solutions. But I do think there needs to be a cyclic process where, when we've talked about in the past, before AI was a thing, we were just trying to think to how to deal with data, right? Was if we had our own scoring process, if something was unknown or didn't hit that criteria for we should put this in front of somebody to react to, how do we keep it in the hopper so that a week from now, if we re-enrich anything on the context, because new things might be learned, will that change the score? And if it increases the score or not, then do we put it in front of somebody or something to do, right? So I think those types of processes to not make everything a yes or no binary, like there's more of a process than that, I think it's always good to have kind of built in, because it kind of, it's your backstop in a way, right? It's not just going to say we're going to let things fall through the cracks.
Yeah, and you also get in the other side of that where you, yeah, you also get on the other side of that too, where you have your things that are just so black box. So the feedback loop that might be there doesn't really get you where you want to be, you know.
Even
so
like, over, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, and even if I didn't, you know, I would want to see something that's, because let's say there, you go to your analogy, Lee, you have that 75% confidence rate alert, but you don't have a way to feedback to train the model to get better on it. You're just relying on the system that's given to you too, because it's so black box, but you don't necessarily want to shut it off. So then what happens is you end up in this position where you're just moving pile.
You're kind of like over-reliant at that point, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of like a limbo, especially for like a SOC or anybody that's doing threat response or reacting to these alerts, right? Whatever it is, like you get caught in limbos with those. That's why they're like, you know, back to the threat, like, yeah, Hives on anything that's black box or I can't tune or
that's why I feel like, I agree. I feel like when you think of like that central pane of glass or like that core security suite tool or whatever, I don't feel like I would want to put AI in the middle and spoke everything to it on the outside. No, I feel like AI should be one of the nodes on the outside that's feeding into the thing in the middle, right? So like whatever that is from like your security architecture and your workflow, that's how I would want to introduce it at least.
I mean, remember a little while ago when like OpenAI went down for a while? And like all of a sudden, all these tools ever like didn't work.
That's true. That's a vulnerability itself, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
But yeah, so speaking of vulnerabilities, vulnerability management, I think this is an interesting place for AI for a couple ways I could see it being leveraged, but I wonder if you guys put any thought into it.
So this one, I think, could be my an instant take on this is you AI can be leveraged heavily to integrate vulnerability management into the rest of your, you know, your kind of operational foothold, however that is. I think you could and I've seen some instances of this. It's more with homegrown stuff, but how do you integrate? So there's a couple phases, right? So you do the vulnerability management to understand what's in your environment, what is vulnerable, what is the more critical versus not critical things, what things you have to address. That's one part, right? But the other part is how does it feed into the rest of your process? So to your intel team to understand how to assess new risks to this or exploits that might be in the wild for a given vulnerability that's just announced. To your engineering team to make sure that you have the right stuff in place or you have the detections in place that are needed to manage or to respond to this thing, to your SOC to be able to work that flow. And then also I think there is efforts and capabilities to take because I've seen flaws in the AI side of vulnerability management too, where they over assess a risk. So they'll say this thing is super critical to your environment. Well, that's that environment variable that comes into play where it's like, actually, this sits behind these 17 firewalls. The chance of this getting obliterated is basically 2%. So the risk needs to be leveraged and dropped a little bit. And there's some fluctuation there. So AI can definitely be in play here. But some of the stuff that at least that I've seen try to be implemented isn't all the way there, or it doesn't consider the rest of the spokes in the wheel for your security operations, right?
Yeah, my take is vulnerability management, where I've seen really good vulnerability programs, there's usually one thing at play, and there's usually somebody on the team that does vulnerability management that is very technical. I've seen teams that do vulnerability management, and there's not a lot of technical people. They kind of rely on the tools to tell them what's important, and then it becomes whatever's flagged high and whatever they can wrap their heads around when they talk to owners of certain assets. Is this really that bad? That becomes the determination a lot of times, which is okay, and that sometimes is what you got. And, you know, it does allow for a lot of major things being holes being fixed. But where I think AI can help is one, it can either close that technical gap where when you're looking at vulnerabilities to help people who aren't technical or don't understand the vulnerability possibly understand it better so they can make more informed decisions. So I think that's a key aspect for me. But the other is there's something to be said about an asset, and you mentioned that could be behind 7 firewalls. Like, what is the distance it is from the internet? And I mean by distance, like how many networks do you move through? How many controlled devices do you move through? What are those, like, for instance, if you're behind 7 firewalls, well, if they all have open access to a port it's vulnerable on, it doesn't matter. But if those firewalls are configured to already block that port, so there's no exposure, it does matter, right? So then the risk is really something has to get past the firewall in a different way and then come laterally to it if it wanted to. And I think if you're able to incorporate that data, which is in some environments can be incredibly complex, but if AI can help analyze that, and take into account that information, I think that would be a great solution, right, to how you prioritize and defend your decision making. And that's important too when you even talk about compliance. A lot of times, compliance has requirements for you need to do these things, and there's a lot of effort always spent because you don't have the time or effort to justify why you wouldn't do something. Because the amount of documentation it takes to prove your case, vet it, or whatever. But if you ever were to have a really full, even to help prioritize what you do in that space to potentially save time and effort and still, you know, provide a robust security when it comes to vulnerability management, I think that can be very, very huge. But challenge is still there. Asset inventory. Configuration management. Like, there's certain things that already have to be in place that are basic security controls before you can even consider trying to implement an idea like I just pitched. I don't think you can say, well, we don't do any of that stuff, but we use AI to help us make our determinations for vulnerability management. I guarantee you've got holes, right? So there's a little bit of that.
That's what it would be if someone created an AI tool that said, hey, here's the CV that came out. Here's, and you'll see it tied into asset inventory. Here's how many were, you know, and oh, by the way, we tested it. We created a proof of concept. We already tested it, and 9 out of 10 of those are protected, but you have one off. Would you let?
I think it'd be more fun that if you had a tool and you didn't have all the information and it didn't do all your homework ahead of time to make sure you're doing things the right way, that when you said, what do I need to patch first? And it just tells you everything. And it's just because you didn't actually manage your environment. You're expecting it to do the work. But I digress. So really next big case, right? Predictive analysis. So this is something where I think a lot of people try to market to from an AI perspective of how it's going to be able to prove the future so we can get ahead of all those potential risks or attacks. What are your thoughts there?
So the predictive analytics side, this is the place where I think AI can, you know, make waves. As Anirudh kind of mentioned in the chat, he was talking about the he's really interested, or they're talking about being really interested in seeing the growth in network anomaly detection. This is kind of, I think, goes into that predictive analytics side. Simply for the one point that I think is going to require a machine level sorting through, it's just the volume of data. So you can do more. The predictive analytics, like we had mentioned, where you talk about like data retention, you can do more with more data. So the larger your data set gets, the harder it's going to be for just the traditional approaches or human to kind of sort through in a traditional way. So AI can really start plugging away at this. I think especially if you have some kind of a machine learning model that's considering some of the things that are being developed or known, like if you're building your own model in-house, where you can consider your environment variables, of course, but also kind of plug into the model the things that are of concern. And sort through all of that data with that in consideration. I don't know. I think predictive analytics is a place where AI can have a big bang, especially when it comes to the network side.
I think so. Good. Is it Mexican standoff here? I feel like this might be tied to like UBA almost, where like it takes a look at your data. Like, in the number one thing I think about is like people scrolling the internet, right? Like, who is just scrolling the internet the most, clicking links, not double checking, you know, like. And like, you're feeding all that data in, right? And then you have like your people that aren't doing anything on the internet. You got this one person or a couple people that are just hammering away at Instagram and all that stuff.
So you're almost like identifying high risk activity already in your environment from your predictive and analytics perspective. Right. So that's interesting. That's not like how I was thinking about it, but I think there is an interesting case there.
I mean, because, you know, like, or who's downloading a bunch of files? Where does that stuff come from? Who has the most mark of the web stuff on their computer? You know, who takes their machine and connects to different hotspots all over the place? I don't know. Like, I feel like that might be a nice place for, yeah, like it says, user analytics kind of.
So I've always liked the idea of like either log level or, alert based or detection rule based and things like that, where sometimes you can have really noisy stuff. And so you don't want to be like looking at everything. But it'd be interesting to take what you said, where let's identify the highest risk assets or people or whatever. I mean, people are assets on the network anyways. And maybe they get a different configuration almost applied because of that behavior, almost like an adaptive security based on user asset based risk model, which would be interesting. Kind of what you described. Where was I going to go? Oh, the other thing with the network side. I can't remember the name of the tool, but when I remember we were looking at it, and it made me think of like that whole attack path flow. It was like Red something. But basically what you would do is you would give it all your configurations for your firewalls, your routers, your switches, and it would build a virtual environment of your environment. And based on all the routing and controls in place, would show you all the viable network attack paths where data could flow. So if you needed to attack something, it would identify all those holes. And for a really, really large environment, especially with lots of devices, I mean, that's kind of a cool concept. For that, a predictive analysis from like lateral movement perspectives, like it's one thing if you know someone can, you know, hey, yeah, if you get to the jump host, you can get to the protected environment. That's good. I mean, that's you predicted that, you planned that. But it's interesting if you had some other kind of predictive, I mean, it's almost like your vulnerability management. People usually don't lump that stuff in. But what are those predictive attack paths based on process, based on configuration, based on architecture? I think that's an assessment that doesn't happen at a fine grain scale. Like, you know, people will pay for services and people come in and they find something. And as long as they find enough things, they kind of stop looking because it's time and effort and money. But I do think that would be kind of interesting use for like the predictive side for sure.
Red Seal?
Red Seal. Yep, that's it.
All right.
Yeah. It's a cool solution. We ended up not going with it for a number of reasons, but when seeing the solution, I really liked the concept a lot. So endpoint protection and malware detection from an AI perspective. I mean, I'm not really, yeah.
I think this is the battle we're already faking. Malware detection, maybe, like processes being injected. Going back to the anomaly thing, Notepad has never spawned command.exe, right?
And I can see like in your environment, like if you see weird behavior and then it's starting to pop up and you can see it from a time lapse type trend, like a temporal, like this hits, then this hits, and something similar behavior starts propagating it's never seen before. Yeah, I can see like that being something that it makes sense for AI to kind of potentially do. That might be hard to build detections around. But for the most part, I don't know. I don't feel like that's filling that big of a gap based on there's been so much focus in this space already and so many tools that do, I think, a pretty good job. And it's not like these tools are necessarily getting defeated by mostly malware. They're getting defeated by things that you would never classify as malware to begin with. It's more behaviors using lol bins and things of that nature, which is why we threat hunt versus just rely on detections alone. So yeah, it's kind of,
You know what would be something? Sorry, Tom, I'll get to you in a second. I just read a report this morning, and looking at the process chain of just loading the malware, there were like 3 or 4 different file types involved. That would be something to be cool, like that I think AI would be really beneficial. I was saying like, hey, for some reason, you know, looking at this executable firing, there were, you know, looking at the steps before it, there were all this type of stuff happening. Files being created, code being extracted from, you know, like that would be interesting to look at when it comes to times, file count, and so on, versus a normal opened up Window Explorer and hit calc.
There's a lot of ways to attack it, right? And it's just a matter of, does it need to be AI or not, is where I guess I'm not sold.
Yeah,
I kind of think more that the AI isn't necessarily the play in this spot, just because of something like you said, Scott, of a lot of stuff has already kind of been done in this area. But I can see enhancements into automation efforts. You know, maybe that's, you can leverage AI to help with automation efforts as far as like contextualizing what you see, or maybe in given situations, if you can customize it, please don't trust out of the box solutions to do this, but take automated actions, you know, like locking, you know, isolating a machine, or, you know, pulling something from the network, or any given thing that you can kind of think of for an automation perspective. But I don't know, just simply when you talk endpoint protection and malware detection, this goes right to the threat detection side. So it's hives. Total hives. I'm getting a lot of hives today.
Benadryl then.
Yeah, it's not here. It's not here right now. I'm gonna need some as soon as we
clearly transparent, open or white box AI.
No, that was great.
You know, Addis calculators and as it does it manually.
Modifiability, yeah, and I hate that because like I want the thing to be there, but it's like, yeah, I just have too many scars from dealing with out of the box type things that, you know, had the buzzwords and the fancy stuff, and it's like, okay, I just spent 2 years trying to get it to functionally work in my environment. Now what?
What if it was Christian Bale from The Big Short? Would you trust it?
I'd get closer to trusting it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This project I'm gonna start now.
I know a lot of us haven't really worked in the banking space, and I have a couple of things to really add, so I don't think we have to dwell on this one too much, but you know, it's fraud detection and prevention. This, I do feel AI has a place, because I look at it similar to network traffic. Like network traffic, I think Anuru mentioned earlier, like it's a great place because there's this certain way things typically or have to communicate, and there's patterns within that. With the way people do banking and purchasing and stuff like that, there's also trends and, you know, standard behaviors. The one thing I think is interesting here is I was listening to a guy who put together this really, really great fraud detection framework. And what I had found out from the bank that he actually worked at is they had multiple fraud groups. I mean, we think security siloed. I mean, we're talking like, I want to say he said there was something like 600 people or something on the fraud teams, but within that, they're individual teams that deal with different frauds, and they didn't really talk to each other or share data with each other. But with looking at fraud, he is able to say, well, gosh, if they're doing these things in this fraud or this space, it directly ties to this, and they use the same resources for this. And so there's all these like interconnects as a security professionals approach things. And understanding the data the way he was describing it, and also the patterns that already kind of exist that may not be even looked at, I think AI, for the same reason we looked at network data, would work really well, with the one caveat that how people collect and sort and store that data, I think, isn't standardized across, you know, every financial institution. So there would be some, you'd be able to train and burn in on your own kind of environment data sets that way. But yeah, so that was kind of my fraud. I don't know if you guys have anything else you want to add there, but I'm just going to throw that out there.
I wonder if it's, I think that it may require, as this stuff continues to scale, when we talk about, like, especially from the fraud side of the house, it's almost, I mean, what do you guys think? In my mind, I think it's going to kind of require AI to defend against fraud from AI. Like, and I'm specifically referencing.
Oh, because AI drives fraud. Yeah.
And stuff like thinking about the deepfake stuff and the things that we've seen just for, you know, people being able to impersonate others, things like that, that we've talked about in recent weeks of, you know, the weekly podcast and stuff. Like, I almost feel like it's going to require some level of AI net to detect if this thing coming to you is AI, right? To prevent some of that fraud.
So I agree that's the initial response, but I guess my take is AI is going to get, or our tools and our ways we do attack will get so good, there will not be a, if you see this, we can detect it even with using AI against it. Because if I were to say, for instance, if the screen of you right now that I see on video is exactly what AI produced, what's going to tell me it's wrong? You know what I mean? There might not be telemetry there to say that's actually fake. So I think process is more important. Say,
well, you're going to have to say on process. You're definitely right on the process side. However, we see that even now the processes are thwarted, right?
Right. But I feel like we're focused so much on detecting the face value of things versus, okay, who cares if we trust it? What process are we going to build, modify, enhance so that regardless of what is fakely generated, it's got to go through these types of hurdles that make it much harder to generate on the fly or whatever. So
yeah, but that, you know, when I hear when you say that, and this is just a competing thought, so we tend to agree a lot. So I want to throw this back at you a little bit. What I hear when you say that is phishing training. That's what I hear. And I'm like, we know that that only works to a certain point, right? And then you want to try to find this other way to, because you can put all the pills in
there,
but
it just says it's human flaw, right? People, right? I think there's technical processes. Well, that doesn't mean ASFR, right?
Yeah, ASFR.
So there's like a lot of, I think there's a lot of checks and balances there. And for an attack to be perfect, I think the compromise has to already exist. If it, you know what I mean? Because they have enough access to get by everything. But if the compromise isn't already 100%, which they probably wouldn't do the attack if they already had the access, that means they're missing certain things that if you understand the things they are missing and that they're trying to get, you can use that against attacks. I know I've like oversimplified the hell out of that, but that's kind of where my head goes when it comes to how do you deal with really crazy sophisticated attacks. Like, well, they're not 100% sophisticated because they're missing something.
I mean, my mind just goes to business email compromise right away. Like, that's all I could think about. When we think about cybersecurity in businesses, like, that's, I mean, unless you're like a financial institution that's looking at a bunch of like banks and numbers. But honestly, I was trying to, I think you nailed it. The process is what you're doing. But business email compromise, like, how would that detect and prevent, I guess, I mean, going back to data set, I mean, data retention, data set anomalies, that's always like how I'm thinking. And like, all right, when was the last time the CEO or a C-suite person emailed you?
Right, you know? Right. But, I need Apple gift cards. When is that even normal? I don't even know what happened.
Yeah, but on the other side, you see these stories where you have like, you know, Marco Rubio, somebody impersonating him, actually getting into conversations with foreign officials and U.S. politicians, like successfully leveraging an impersonation tool to successfully
like,
the conversation point. And that's like, can we is there just a gap that humans can't solve in those types of things?
But you know what's even funny is like we solve that problem in communication in like World War eras, because you used to have to call, and if you had to talk or deliver really sensitive things, you had to confirm your identity and have a code word that was on file that only that people knew in that process to validate whatever it was. And I even remember, I don't remember what my code, I thought it was dumb because I didn't commit anything to memory, but I remember they're like, well, if you get captured, you got to give us some sort of code word that's going to let us know that you're in distress or you're lying or you're whatever. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And I came up with something and I put it on a piece of paper and I had no idea what it was, you know, like, but that's what I'm saying. But like I'm saying, like we've already thought about these solutions historically and we use them. And so it's not like it has to be overly complex. Now is it going to require some work? You know, people can't be lazy, but I think like stuff like that can make that going to reduce or negate the risk, and just knowing that, yeah, the risk is out there. So we have to just work a little harder.
Human to human 2FA, huh? So we got a two-factor conversations with each other.
Convenience, man. Convenience is always what's been at the bane of security, right? We're like, hey, we're so sophisticated. Things are already innately secure under the hood. I can just act like a normal person. It's like, no, you got to just be skeptical, and you got to have ways to validate things outside of technology. So anyways, off my soapbox. Next is cyber asset attack surface. I think this is interesting. I think we kind of hit on a lot of these things when it comes to like mapping a network or vulnerability management. So I think that's what a lot of the attack surface is. But I think it kind of plays into cloud a little bit, right? Because it's so easy to spin up devices and configuration management. I think there's a place for that. And understanding how clouds are configured and permissions. So that's kind of where I kind of sit with some of that. I don't know if you guys have thoughts there.
I don't know. We might have to bookend it. I didn't realize the time, Scott.
Oh, I know. We're gonna push to close to the end, and then I'll give some announcements. Because we only got.
I thought this one. This one was definitely brought up to already earlier. I think this one ties into that from AI, from my perspective, is this is integrating with the rest of your systems, allowing it to create more functional informational piece to all of your areas of security, like understanding how to intertwine that, similar to vulnerability. Ability management, things like that, like and even mentioned in chat a few times. This is where I see this playing in.
Yeah, and honestly, like the next category is cloud security, where people are trying to use AI a lot. And I think this is only important because people don't realize almost all cloud compromises deal with access and how access is given based on identities and things like that. And it's hard to audit sometimes or even understand. And I think having a layer of AI to assist, especially with non-technical people or cloud people or security people who are required, or non-security people who are required to set up and run cloud environments, I think there is a great oversight capability that could exist with the whole AI interconnect there. But yeah, so for closing out, just a quick call out. We have some upcoming things to make people pay attention to. We're going to do a part two of the series because we actually have a lot more content that we knew we weren't going to get to. So we'll be one announcing that. So we'll be doing another live edition, finishing out and diving even deeper than we already dove into in some key areas, cloud related stuff. But there is going to be an Intel driven threat hunting workshop analyzing malware behaviors on July 31st. That's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Hands on, get your feet wet kind of thing, dealing with malware and looking at behaviors there. Also, if you're going to Black Hat this year, there will be an Intel 471 booth, and it's booth 5742. Definitely check it out. Tom will be there. You can go harass him, meet him.
Tom will be there.
He'll be representing us in Jimbo's.
Hello.
But yeah, I definitely want to thank everyone for joining. Again, loving having these conversations. It's fun to kind of dive deep into some things or even speculate some things as well. If you like what you hear, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really just about anywhere you actually listen to your content or get it. Leave good reviews. It helps us get discovered so we can get more people involved in the conversation. If you like some of the stuff you hear here, then definitely check out, we kind of do a weekly segment that's about 30, 45 minutes where we touch on new topics, reports, things happening, the current news, write-ups and so forth, and try to do a technical dive from a threat hunting perspective. So definitely check that out. And with that, I want to thank everybody for their time. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.